The thing about AI transparency is I've always been a fan of applying AI to constrained problems, well thought through data sets. And I just become concerned about kind of the sloppy nature of data collection practices, kind of overblown promises about what these algorithms could do.
This isn't just some magic box. There is inputs and outputs to it like any other system. And it should be broken down and understood at a baseline level. It's kind of part of the gig to have to raise money. This is just a different ecosystem to raise money in. And like any new ecosystem, we're climbing a steep learning curve there, but we'll see what we can do a day at a time here.
And the equity they get is a stake in the future of
that's
transparency
correct.
And it's, democracy.
It's,
and
yeah. That's right. No,
it's life as we know it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Artificial intelligence is a powerful technology that can shape our future, but it also poses many challenges and risks. One of the most pressing issues is the lack of regulation and oversight over the data that AI uses to learn and make decisions. Addressing this problem is a new Seattle-based nonprofit called the Transparency Coalition at transparencycoalition.ai. It's aiming to promote ethical and responsible AI practices. I'm GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop, and on this episode, I'll be talking with the founders of the Transparency Coalition, Rob Elleveld and Jay Jasima. It's great to have you both here.
Glad to be here, Todd. Thanks.
Excited to be here. Thank you.
So, Rob, why don't we start with you? Just a little bit of background on yourself and how you got to this point.
Sure. I've been here in Seattle 25 years and was a submarine officer right out of school, and then 25 years in the tech industry after graduate school. There's some graduate school in between there, but I've been in kind of technical things around either nuclear power or technology and software for all of my career, and here I am.
And both of you are startup founders multiple times. So Jay, tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, I came to Seattle in the late 80s, actually, to get a PhD at the University of Washington. I have a PhD in the electrical and computer engineering, I guess, worked in areas that you would consider AI today. And then I've been in and out of big and small companies and worked on several applications, software service application businesses, benefited from NLP or AI over the years. I've been in Seattle for 35 years this year. So,
how did the two of you connect? How did the Transparency Coalition come to fruition? And we're going to talk about the bigger picture problem, but I'm curious first just about the roots of this organization that you both founded.
I got concerned about sort of the scope and the scale and the speed of generative AI specifically starting about last spring. MasterCard had acquired a company I was running, and I was just at the end of a two-year integration period after that acquisition. And around about summer, Jay and I, who've been both friends and colleagues in the tech community here for at least 15 years, were talking about it literally on a camping trip. And I was saying I was going to do something, and Jay said we should have coffee afterwards, and we got to talking. And Transparency Coalition started in October officially. It's when we incorporated in Delaware and got our, you know, IRS, our EIN number and so forth. But that's kind of how it came about.
You know, it's funny. People always talk about fireside chats. This literally was a fireside chat. We were, you know, waving the smoke out of our eyes and trying to chat at the same time. Some interesting discussions about the problem areas. But then I think the question was, how could we bring the focus to something that a small organization that could accomplish or make some headway in? And that's how we kind of arrived at the proposition that Transparency Coalition addresses.
Rob, you alluded to this a little bit, but what was it that made this issue of data transparency in the training of AI models front of mind for you at this moment? And by the way, where were you camping?
Whidbey Island.
Yeah. You were camping on Whidbey Island. Okay.
Fort Eby, right.
So you're sitting there on Whidbey Island. Normally you'd be enjoying the cool island breezes coming off of the sound. But here you were thinking about AI transparency. Why?
So I think the thing about AI transparency is I've always been a fan of applying AI to constrained problems, well thought through data sets. And I just become concerned about kind of the sloppy nature of data collection practices, kind of overblown promises about what these algorithms could do. And so I think that was kind of the, coming from sort of that experienced practitioner background, I was just concerned about that. And I think we were concerned about what people would then over react to what AI was producing, and you know, whether it's misinformation or disinformation, other types of hallucinations that people were seeing. And so we really wanted to figure out, like, what is that? And the heart of it all was the inputs of the AI. So that's really where we arrived at. There's lots of different AI models, many different algorithms. All of them share the same data collection practices and the data underlying training data. And that's where a lot of the problems are rooted. So,
yeah, I can add just a little bit more. The company I ran was called Ekata. It spun out of White Pages that was acquired by MasterCard. And we focused on identity verification, basically fraud detection, whether this is Jay online transacting to buy something or someone that bought Jay's credit card on the dark web, maybe made up a Gmail address that looked like his, and so forth. And so we gave scores to our customers, and we had basically all of the big e-tailers, a lot of big banks as customers around the world, not just here. So our scores were machine learning, which today is 80% of what AI is, really, is just predictive models. Machine learning, we did a lot of curation of our training data, because in machine learning, you're feeding the machine the answer key, and then it learns from the answer key, the outputs, in our case, is this fraud or not, what the input patterns look like. So I understood training data quite well, because we worked with our customers to gather it around the world, and it was a pretty big effort. And in generative AI right now, with most of what's out there today, the training set is completely unconstrained. It's anything that can be crawled. It's a lot of things behind paywalls. It's personal information. It's copyrighted information. It's things posted on fake news. There's little to no curation of it. And when you don't have any curation of the input, the key input, which is training data, there's three inputs to AI. There's compute power, which is effectively infinite on AWS or Azure. There's a model. Those have been open sourced by Facebook. So at the 95th percentile, they're all commodity. There may be a 98th percentile model out there, but the models are commodity. That's the second input. And then training data. So training data is literally the only big major input at this point that's out there. And it's completely unconstrained, the collection and use of it, which means the outputs are very randomized in a lot of ways because the training data is uncurated in generative AI.
And this gets to the big question and really the reason for the formation of the Transparency Coalition. How much visibility do people outside these companies, or frankly, even inside these companies, have into exactly what data are being used in the creation of these models currently? How much visibility is there?
So I think one of the things that most companies, will not give you any transparency, if you really look at the papers that even OpenAI published over the years, when they started out, they were very detailed about what training data they used. As time has gone on, I think someone said when Sora was released, there was like half a sentence, right? And so literally, I think they're viewing training data both as some sort of trade secret, even though it's other people's data. But in addition, there's probably some implicit acknowledgement that there's things that are potentially not kosher that are being collected.
So there was some news recently on this front. The Allen Institute for AI, AI2, came out with a whole new large language model.
Almo.
Basically a truly open source large language model that they say is designed to advance the science of language models collectively. Is this the ideal in what you're striving for? In other words, is it transparent to the level that you would want it, or is it a step in the right direction?
So I think we've been talking to the Allen Institute of AI folks, including the research team. And one of the areas that a lot of the current models struggle with is research-driven models are typically used to considering data as fair use because, there's a data set called the Common Crawl, which is a data set that's been used by many of these model developers. And it does not, unfortunately, discriminate between what is copyrighted and what isn't. And so that data set is a key building block of Almo. The great thing about Almo, of course, is that they have actually been very open about what data sets they're using and, really detailed that out. So that is a key first step. But I think the second really important step is making sure that the underlying data sets themselves are data that has been opted in by the content rights holder, because the line between fair use and commercial use should be very bright. But unfortunately, I think a lot of data is being used potentially released under fair use provisions, but then being used for not at the Allen Institute, obviously, because they're a research institution and this is a research model. But I think if the same practices were embraced by the commercial community, that would be good for everybody.
Interesting quick story for you. We're trying to influence policy at the state level because the states just move faster. And as we, I think, all know, the Congress at the federal level is tied in knots right now. And Jay and I were on a call with a staffer who heads AI policy for a key assemblywoman down in California. There's a whole number of AI bills under consideration this session is in California. And one of them is focused on AI transparency, actually. And we asked him what the assemblywoman's, how she came to this. And he had two stories. But one of them, I think, is very relevant to what Jay's just talking about. The University of California had a bunch of researchers that were doing research on generative AI. They downloaded the associated training data with the model they were using. It turned out there was child pornography in the training data. And when they learned it, they had to wipe all of the servers in the University of California system with anything to do with this large language model and its training data because there was child pornography buried in there. At the scale and the volume that it's going on at right now, that's a microcosm of what's happening out there. And that's why she introduced the bill. It just gives you kind of a tangible example of something.
Do the companies themselves know what's being used in there?
We've heard anecdotally that there's been decisions to not track where their crawlers go. So there's not effectively an electronic trail of what's in there. Anybody that's doing this at scale, Google knows exactly what they crawl. They know what they index. They have to. It's their business for search. And the associated companies that do this at scale, they have all sorts of capability to track these things.
So this gets to the question of solutions and the mission of the Transparency Coalition. So I want to talk about that. When we come back, you're listening to GeekWire, and we will be right back.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Rob Eleveld and Jay Jasima, the co-founders of the Transparency Coalition. So we've gotten a sense for the problem here. All of these large language models are becoming very ever-present in our lives, and we really don't have an understanding or a grasp of the source material that they're all using to produce these answers, which creates all sorts of complications potentially. So you founded the Transparency Coalition. What is your goal as an organization, as a nonprofit? How do you hope to address this issue?
We really have two objectives at the Transparency Coalition. The first is to influence policy at the state level. We feel like state and federal policymakers that are sitting on their hands, we saw that play out for 20 years in social media. And to not do anything and hope for the best has not worked out well there. And so doesn't mean there's not some positives of social media, but we also have 41 attorneys general suing Facebook right now, many years too late to protect our kids. And so there's no judgment on social media broadly, but there should be some policies in place given how big of an impact there is on our society. And so one of our goals is to educate state legislatures and be a conduit or a support policy in that sense. And the second is a more broad educational effort to people that care. It's not the whole society, but it's some portion of the society that cares. Policymakers, business executives and managers not in the tech community, other stakeholders in the society that need to understand that this isn't just some magic box. There is inputs and outputs to it like any other system, and it should be broken down and understood at a baseline level. And if it is understood, then people start asking the right kind of questions and hopefully coming to some better policy positions. They're never going to be perfect, but transparency is better, broadly stated. If things are transparent in the training data, some other large problems start taking care of themselves. Namely, data starts getting licensed. There is no other industry in the world that doesn't have to license intellectual property. I don't know why this one's different. There's tomes of books at any law school on copyright and intellectual property. This is not a new thing. Hundreds of years of background in business law there. And it applies here. If you have to license training data, it becomes part of your cost of goods. So the projects get narrower and smaller and more focused on detecting stage 3 pancreatic cancer as opposed to trying to answer every question ever posed by humanity. We think narrower and more focused generative AI is much better for the society. It's much more controlled. You can trace the outputs if they skew off to what the inputs or the training data was, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of things that start to take care of themselves. Also, privacy, key element that takes care of itself if there's opt-in requirements and training data transparency. That's a little bit about the mission and what we're trying to get done.
I think the other thing we found, when we were talking, especially the other AI researchers, people, there's a large research community that works in what's called responsible or transparent AI. There's a responsible AI systems group at the University of Washington that we work pretty closely with. I mean, they're frustrated too because they also have counterparts inside large companies. But in the race to be first, a lot of the knowledge and wisdom about how to make these things govern themselves a little bit has been brushed aside because everybody wants to be first. And so I think we want to make sure that policymakers and others understand and are able to connect with these thinkers. And so we're not going to have all the best ideas about, how to solve these problems, how to detect, when the problem is occurring. So we definitely rely on our partnerships with researchers and think tanks to bring these ideas to the forefront. So we're not only, advocating, but we're also informing and educating.
To some extent, I can imagine one of the challenges might be the fact that these technologies have so captured the imagination of many people. I can envision somebody saying to you, well, geez, I want ChatGPT to give me amazing answers. I don't care which book it violated the copyright from to give that to me. And I recognize that's not a principled response, but I could see where in the general public there might be some resistance to putting these kinds of restrictions on what these AI models can do.
There are definitely examples of companies that are doing it right or doing it as well as can be done today, right? In the model development space, there's a company called Hugging Face that we think is very good about really talking about its data and where it's coming from. They're viewed as a market leader. There's another startup called Perplexity.ai that seems to be doing good work in providing provenance for its answers. So they're trying to provide answers, but also tell you where it's coming from. Anytime you start thinking about chatbots as a replacement for traditional search engines that as they existed before the advent of AI, has poisoned the water even for traditional search engines because there's so much AI-generated falsehoods that are being re-ingested by these engines. So I think it's something that there are ways to do it differently and right. We are people that have both benefited from building AI-driven companies, and we think it's possible to build very robust, interesting, useful businesses that leverage AI, just not the way they're doing it now.
The other big headline that's come out on this front has been the New York Times lawsuit against Microsoft and OpenAI, specifically over copyright. I can imagine in the world that you're describing, in the better world that you hope to help bring about, that would be very clear. There would be no question that there was a copyright violation there because in the model, you would be able to see it's pretty much very obvious, regardless, given some of the evidence that the Times has put in the lawsuit. But in this scenario, you would be able to see transparently the fact that the OpenAI GPT-4 crawler pulled in content from the New York Times. Am I thinking about it in the right way?
That's correct. And, there's other lawsuits. Getty Images right here in town is suing Stability, .ai, for ingestion of their copyrighted content. There's a whole group of well-known authors that have filed lawsuits. And Google just announced, or Reddit just announced as part of their IPO, a large licensing deal with Google, which would indicate, why would Google license from Reddit if they didn't need to license something? So the question is, why haven't they licensed? That's 0.001% of what they've ingested. Okay, so why would they license from one company and not all of the other copyright owners. But understand in general, this isn't just about copyright. This is also about controlled use of private data, opt-in use of private data. Right now, any image posted on social media of kids, of friends, of private moments, it's all being ingested. There's no control over it. And until there's some transparency that says this is what's being ingested and this isn't, I think people should be concerned about that. And they have a right to be concerned. And so this is about education. We can't do it ourselves. One thing we have found out in the sort of this marketplace, if you will, in the policy marketplace is there's many, many concerned stakeholders on one side of the equation, whether they're copyright holders, whether they're small businesses, whether, frankly, they're startups with a good idea, but a fraction of the compute power of some of the larger organizations. And so if their idea becomes anything interesting, the compute power and being able to just take whatever training data is available overwhelms what they can do. There's obviously privacy concerns. There's people writing op-eds. That's all on one side of kind of the marketplace, if you will. On the other side is policymakers. If there's anything Jay and I have learned in the past 3 or 4 months interacting here in the state of Washington, down in California specifically, because that's where we are right now, our real focus is 10 to 12 states. We think it's a bipartisan issue. We don't just want to be in West Coast states. We don't want to be just in red or blue states, but both. In any state legislature, the legislators themselves are extraordinarily time constrained, and they're dealing with a host of everyday issues that really matter to people. In fact, most of what impacts people day to day happens at the state level, not at the federal level. And so they don't have time or the staff to focus on a specific issue, especially a complex one like generative AI or how fast it's moving. And so that bridge between a lot of kind of potential energy on one side that's bottled up, it's concerned a lot of stakeholders, and the kinetic energy of some actual policy in place, that bridge between those two, there's a big vacuum there. And we don't purport to be the only folks there. We don't purport to be the experts everywhere, but we get up every day and think about this one issue. And so we have the advantage of being able to try and puts things in place that's digestible for policymakers. And that's what we're trying to do.
How are you funding the organization?
My wife and I have funded it to date on seed funding, and we're a 501c4, which is, Jay and I learned from the lawyers. 501c3 is a typical charity, and you get a tax write-off for it. A 501c4 has a lot more flexibility to lobby and influence policy, but there's no tax write-off for it. So it's a nonprofit, but there's no tax write-off to donate to it. So we're in the business of getting grants from organizations, either foundations or family offices that aren't looking for the tax write-off, but are looking for the policy influence, or are concerned about this issue broadly, and corporations in that vein. You know, that's part of the quest right now, if you will. Part of the journey is to raise money along the way. We've both raised money. I've been a CEO 4 times. Jay's been a startup CEO. It's kind of part of the gig to have to raise money. This is just a different ecosystem to raise money in. And like any new ecosystem, we're climbing a steep learning curve there. But we'll see what we can do a day at a time here.
And the equity they get is a stake in the future of
that's
transparency
correct.
And
it's,
democracy.
It's,
and
yeah. That's right. No,
it's life as we know it.
Exactly. Yeah. Hopefully it's more equity than might be gained from a stock share, but it's a broader concept.
On the New York Times suit, just to go back to that briefly, one of the things that strikes me is you've got multiple paths here, and that is potentially the judicial path to coming up with some sort of precedent or clarity. Do you think there's the potential for that to come up with a solution in the courts before some sort of consensus emerges from the state legislatures around the country?
So I think that covers a slice of content, right? That's the thing, is it's very high value content that I personally pay for every day from the New York Times, and I love it and treasure it. But the game in the AI model development is called token count, right? They want to know how many tokens they can amass, and all they care about is where those tokens are going to come from, preferably generated by humans, right? And so they're looking at every possible source of tokens they could find, and copyright content will be a piece of the is a very important piece of it. But as we mentioned, there's content that's on your site, you know, that could that you may wish to at least have a point of view on whether you want to have scraped. Same with others. You want to make sure that when you grant permission to a crawler, you do so for a specific purpose. You want your content to be found? Great, search crawling is okay. AI crawling, maybe a different matter, right? You know, and so I think it's really important to make sure that we just empower people, that policy empowers people. That's the only thing that's going to, I think a staffer I was talking to said that, you know, why aren't they doing this already? I'm like, why? Because you haven't made them, right? And so I think the policymakers have to ensure that structures exist that will then let the industry thrive in a different way. It'll flourish. It just won't be in the way it is today.
Copyright specifically, when we first started, this is one of the things we took a long look at. And when you start going down the copyright law road, you get into a term called fair use and what's fair use and not. And for instance, we were thinking, well, could you spur a lot of class action lawsuits? Well, it's very hard to create what's called a class in copyright law because you have to prove that your specific content is being replicated on an output of an AI-generated system. And it becomes very challenging to understand that, to prove that at a class level. So
the common claim.
The commonality, right. Yes. And so basically, we determined a couple things. One is, without being lawyers and having law backgrounds ourselves, we're going to be out of our depth very quickly, number one. Number two is, it's going to take a long time to play out. And every day that goes by, there are tens of billions of dollars being invested in crawling, scraping, ingestion, tens of billions of dollars a month, literally, going into that. So months matter here, and copyright law works on at least years, if not decades. Okay. And then third is, copyright law was written in a world absent of AI, and it probably needs to be reinterpreted or rewritten, which adds even more time to it. So is it part of the solution? I absolutely believe it is. Is it on the timeline and urgency of what many of us take for granted in the society that literally will be changing drastically if there's not policy put in place? Things need to happen sooner from a policy perspective.
Are you already at the point where you have draft legislation, principles, things that if by some miracle some of these legislators were able to push through in two or three weeks?
We definitely have specific draft legislation coming to us, and we are providing them specific ways to refine it. The definitions of terms aren't standardized, so we're helping to make sure that those definitions are standardized. And then certainly looking at transparency as a core principle, how to define that. In some cases, like the state of Washington has a task force approach to it. So we're helping inform that bill to make sure that the task force takes this into account going forward. But it's certainly in different states, the approach is different. In California, there are specific bills dealing with it. In our state, and then there's other legislatures that are doing something.
We were now testifying in Olympia. I'm flying down to Sacramento tomorrow, and meeting with state legislators in both places and their staffers, not just the state legislators. They're very time constrained. So a lot of times they have a staffer that's kind of an expert in this area that's trying to collect all the information. One of the interesting things is it takes us 10 minutes in a 30-minute meeting to convince someone, we are just concerned citizens. We don't have a profit motive. We don't have a side game. We don't. This is purely. We're concerned citizens, and we're trying to support policy efforts for the vast majority of America, not a very narrow minority that's trying to be the first to create the cyborg god or something like that.
So a third of your meetings typically are establishing credibility and neutrality on the issue.
Neutrality. They're just not used to anybody being in front of them, being willing to work and put in some spade work and educate that don't have a profit motive, because that's just kind of how the system
I've
works.
Had stakeholders say to me, where were you a year ago? Oh. Or you are the answer to my prayer. I mean, it's like fairly, it's goosebump inducing. I would have killed for that, as a startup entrepreneur, when people say, your product is exactly what I've been waiting for. but certainly getting it here, no.
Maybe after this podcast runs, you can just send them a link to this. listen to this on your morning drive into the office, and I'll meet you at the Capitol. But it's interesting that you're focusing on Olympia in Washington State and Sacramento in California, because we've seen this play out here in Washington State. Things like privacy legislation, even though things are stuck at the federal level, if you can get something through in a place where the tech companies are based, it tends to become a model or a template for the other legislatures that assume that they know what they're doing back in those West Coast tech hubs.
There's more coordination than you would think of state legislators in various states. They communicate on lots of policies, not just this one, but they're definitely coordinating on this one, in part because they're very staff constrained, in part because they're concerned about doing something proactively, not just being victims like played out in social media. And so there's a National Council of State Legislators, NCSL. We are hoping, based on some early discussions we've had with a few folks in their legislative staffs, to kind of do a roadshow there. But there's other sort of organized efforts to trade best practices at state legislators. Attorneys general also have group coordinated meetings, and not all of these are partisan. They're also bipartisan efforts. And so one of the big places for AI legislation is the Tennessee legislature. Why? Because Nashville's there and copyrights really matter there and in protecting artists and the country music industry. And so it's great to see that there's a state that would by all means be as red as Washington is blue that's very interested in AI policy. And we would love to support it. We just don't have the resources to get out there right now, but we will.
So what might these new laws look like? That's coming up next.
What would be the one or two or maybe three key components of legislation that you would want to see passed?
Standard definitions of what AI is, what training data is.
Definition of training data, definition of transparency, definition of what is AI that's not based on flavor of the month or the week. You know, I think those would help.
There also just needs to be some audit mechanism. And we've got some work going on an audit mechanism. Obviously, audit needs to be done at scale. So in the last business I was in, we sourced data around the world, licensed it, by the way.
Data
around names, addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, physical addresses, and IP addresses. And we licensed it from all sorts of places. We focused on only places that had the right to license us the data. We focused on not licensing scraped data. But there's data attributes you can put around any file, what would be called a file, electronic file, of key attributes, how big the file is, what the sources were, is it just music content, is it just image content, is it video content, is it written content, volumes, where it came from, what languages it is, that sort of thing, what would be called metadata around the files.
And nutrition facts are a good way to think
of it. Yeah, that's a great way to think of it. Nutrition facts, and you could basically electronically access that via a regulator or a policy organization could electronically access that, and it'd be required if you were a model holder, for instance. There's other ways to do it, but there needs to be an audit mechanism answer.
It would be a behind-the-scenes audit or something that would be a process versus me as a consumer knowing that this chatbot came.
Yeah, it would be very difficult for any person or small business to understand. They need to know that other element is things need to be opt-in, not opt-out. You know, my simple example of opt-out is your laptop sitting here, Todd, and you go to the restroom and I'm like, I kind of like that laptop and I just take it. And that would be opt-out. In other words, you didn't tell me not to take your laptop, so I just took it from you, okay? And the opt-in would be, I would say, hey, Todd, I'd like to use your laptop for a while and you're going to the restroom for half hour. Can I just, you know, use it and work with it? And you'd say, sure, I'll opt into you using my laptop for a while, and I would do that. And so what's going on right now is all opt-out. And whether it's personal data or copyrighted data or whatever, and we think everything needs to be opt-in, but that needs to be audited in some way.
And is there even a choice or an ability to opt out? Like if somebody—
Not really. Little bit. Jake can talk a little bit.
For content scraping in particular, there's now metadata standards that, for example, GeekWire could put on its—
A tag,
instead of a robots.txt file that allows crawling for search, there's extensions to that that allow you to say, do crawl or don't crawl my— You have to do that per model. So every model has its own call sign. And then you have to be able to say, for this, if you have this call sign, you may crawl. If you have this one, you may not. So that is for a website.
But that's only on your honor. There's no audit mechanism for that.
Plus, the other thing that's a problem is that if you decide to put that up and say, don't crawl my site today, they're not going to take the data they already have. So if they've already been crawling your site for the last 2 years,
They're not going to remove
They're not going to remove that. So that is
I mean, a big issue with OpenAI right now is they're trying to ask for legislation. I'm not trying to beat on OpenAI, but they're just the biggest and they're out there. But they want effectively a hall pass for everything they've already crawled, which it's hard to understand just sitting here, billions and billions of written words and books and articles have been ingested. Because what AI is really trying to do is just pattern match to decide what letter goes next to what letter to create a word, to create a sentence, to create a structured sentence that makes sense, that fits into a paragraph. It's all pattern matching. And to pattern match correctly, you have to ingest a huge amount of data. And then there's options in ChatGPT. I want this to sound like a 16-year-old. Well, you have a lot of 16-year-old written content to sound like a 16-year-old, to pattern match like a 16-year-old. Where'd that come from? Well, you know, I mean, it's all supposed to be adults on there, right? Where did that come from? Or I want to write a kid's book. Okay, so now how'd that get in there? Well, either a bunch of copyrighted kid's books or, I don't know, kids using some social media system or something. So in order to pattern match, there's massive volumes of data. And right now, there's three or four or five language models out there that have already ingested a huge amount. And what they really like is a hall pass, but then everybody else needs to follow the new rules, right? We don't think that's a good recipe, and neither does New York Times and Getty Images and these authors and so forth, and the state of Tennessee.
But the ideal in your scenario that you're describing would be, unless I had something up there in the metadata of the site explicitly giving permission, they wouldn't be able to ingest the data.
That's correct.
Or produce that data. Like there's another issue where your content can be regurgitated verbatim, right? You know, if you wanted to say, tell me what John Cook said about XYZ event 2 years ago, you might be able to write a prompt that spewed that content out verbatim.
And to your point, there was an issue with the Microsoft Bing integration into ChatGPT. They had to take it down for a while because people would go to paywalled sites. They'd enter a link for a paywalled story and ask, what does this story say? And it would basically give, maybe not verbatim, but a good enough summary that you would never pay for a subscription.
And how did something behind a paywall get integrated?
Yeah. Okay.
Volume at scale.
Yes.
Getting behind paywalls, taking copyrighted information, that sort of thing.
So for people out there who are interested in this topic, I'll link to the Transparency Coalition website.
Transparencycoalition.ai.
Apart from visiting the site, following your work, listening to this podcast, what can people do if they care about this topic?
They can certainly write their state legislator. They can talk to other concerned constituents, whether it's parents or whether it's other small business owners. They can help educate other people that aren't as familiar with what's going on. And in general, just as a part of our country, be informed about it. I mean, this is a once in a generation type of societal impact in a lot of ways that we don't even know right now. And being informed citizens is going to be really important. Obviously, a lot of people are concerned about, and rightly so, about deepfakes in the coming election. It's a very important election season here and around the world, here in the country and in the states and also around the world. And disinformation is a huge problem with AI.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's been eye-opening for me is how many places our legislators have for us to tell them what we think, that we as citizens don't take advantage of all the time. I attended a town hall with all three of my state legislators. They organize them every 3 months. And I was able to ask them as a citizen about these policies. Some of them had really interesting things to say. You can register when bills are on the vote. You don't even have to testify. You can just tell people. So I think we'll make those sort of citizen activism resources available eventually on our website, so people will be able to find out when something is up, how they can let people know what they think. Just so it's something that people can actually take advantage of.
We plan to have more and more sort of tracking state by state of what's happening. I mean, there's over 400 bills in across 40 state legislators right now regarding AI. A lot of them have to do with deepfakes and election, but still, that's a good number that says there's a real recognition that we can't have social media play out again. And frankly, for Jay and I, for anybody listening out there, it's been quite energizing to interact with state legislators and be down in Olympia. there's a lot of folks that are extremely hardworking, trying to do the right things. They've got a very compressed legislative schedule in most states here and even years. I couldn't believe it when I found out late last fall. But in even years here, the state legislature runs from the second week of January through the end of March, and they got to do appropriations for the budget in there, which is about half that time. So things happen on a very compressed schedule. But our state legislators, everybody we've interacted with, very engaged, trying to do the right thing on a lot of things. It's quite energizing to work and see state government. They just have a breadth of issues to deal with, and they're really trying to do things for their constituents, and what they do impacts people a lot.
Well, Rob and Jay, thank you very much for talking with me. This has been great.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks a lot, Todd.
Rob Elleveld and Jay Jasima are the co-founders of the Transparency Coalition, and you can learn more at transparencycoalition.ai. Thanks for listening. Kurt Milton edited this episode. I'm GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the GeekWire podcast.